Amazon says they're fine with Siri getting some help from Alexa. Andy Rubin's new smartphone company is worth almost $1 billion. And Kyle Weems from iFixit is here to show us the innards of the new 4K iMac. All that and a whole lot more coming up on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1785, recorded Thursday, June 8th, 2017.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays such a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/TNT.
And by Oars and Alps, powerful skincare made for a guy's active lifestyle. Join thousands of men using Oars and Alps today. Go to oarsandalps.com/twit to receive 15% off your first order. And by Tracker, a coin-sized tracking device that pairs with your smartphone and keeps you from losing your most valued possessions. Visit thetracker.com right now and enter promo code TNT to save 20% off any order.
Welcome to Tech News Today. This is the show where we talk tech news all the time, all of it, every bit that is worthy of your ears or eyes. I am Megan Maroney.
I'm Jason Howell. Sometimes we miss little things, like there's the news today that the Apple AirPods are going to work with Apple TV, and that made me happy. There just wasn't a whole lot there to talk about. It's like I'd read it and be like, yeah, so that's happening.
I love that that makes you happy because not only do you not have AirPods, you also don't have an Apple TV.
I like the idea. I want that in my house. I want the ability to do that in my house. But yes, you're right. I have neither of those products.
I have both. And I was like, meh. Yeah. I will use it probably.
Yeah.
I'm a little afraid of it. Like, you know, if I'm, I guess, yeah, I'm not, I don't know. I probably will use it.
Yeah. But I can see when that could come in totally handy.
So that's the news we're not going to talk about.
That's a bonus. Hey, we talked about it. There you go.
Since the announcement earlier this week of Apple's smart speaker called the HomePod, a lot of us have been grumbling about how Siri would need to be smarter for this to really work. But what if she could get some help? This week at the Wired Business Conference in New York, Amazon Senior Vice President of Devices David Limp said Siri should be able to talk to Alexa. According to a piece on Slate.com's Future Tense, this interoperability will limit redundancies in product development and improve innovation. But will it happen? Limp claims that Amazon isn't the one holding up this innovation. He told USA Today, quote, "You should be able to say to your Amazon Echo, ask Siri X, and if Apple or Google want to come calling, my phone number is out there and they can call." Now, I looked up his phone number so I could send it to Tim Cook, but I couldn't find it. So hit me up, David Limp. I want to see this happen.
You want to get in touch with him? Maybe you go home. Well, no, they haven't rolled out phone calling with Google Home yet. I was going to say you could say, hey, G, call David Limp, and maybe it would know his phone number because apparently it's out there. But I don't think that's going to happen yet. That's not going to work.
Well, I mean, I could probably. I mean, I'm assuming that he has an Amazon Echo because he works for Amazon. So
you just call him through the Echo chat.
Yeah.
Or whatever,
I mean, probably that
makes sense too.
Well, he would have to be in my contact. So he wasn't. If David Limp isn't even your contacts, let me know. I mean, clearly he's saying Apple's the one who has a walled garden.
Of course.
We're open to everything because you get, you know, you get, obviously you get the Echo on the HomePod and then you're ordering toilet paper from Amazon.
Do you see Apple opening up Siri so that it works on other home assistants?
No,
I don't see it at all. It just doesn't seem like a very Apple thing to do. I mean, Microsoft did something similar with Cortana, right? They kind of started, they rolled out an app for Android and then they allowed you to kind of embed it into the Android experience. So they took their voice assistant and said, all right, you know, we can open this up to other platforms. But they kind of had a different problem. Like they really just needed that service to grow. And I don't feel like Apple really needs Siri to grow. I think Apple's pretty happy with the user base that they already have with Siri. Although at the same time, interoperability, I would applaud it in all, you know, in all ways as far as this is concerned, especially when we're talking about IoT stuff. As these home assistants are able to control more and more devices, you realize how important interoperability is to the value of that product. So I would love to see this. I just don't see it happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So see, he's not talking about putting Siri on other devices. He's talking about having Alexa on. I mean, and Alexa is on lots of different devices. And same with Cortana, like you were saying, because they don't make hardware. Apple's the only one of these companies. I mean, they all actually do make hardware, but Apple's the only company whose business is really
interpreted
hardware.
This the opposite direction.
Oh, no.
I don't see them putting any Siri hooks on any other devices.
No.
That I could believe a little bit
really,
more.
Really, they would put the Amazon voice services on a HomePod?
Some sort of connectivity between the services, maybe. Yeah, no, you're right. It doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. It's not a very Apple thing to do to allow for multiple different, voice commands or something. But to let the services talk and communicate in some way, it's hard for me to see that happening.
Yeah, I mean, Limp also said that the HomePod and the Echo aren't the same thing philosophically. And what he was implying, he said over and over again, you can get 8 Echo Dots for one HomePod. So basically he was saying, by saying philosophically what Amazon was saying, like, we're for everybody. We're the device for everybody, not just you rich, crazy people who will buy anything from Apple.
Right. I think this is pretty important because I heard some marker squeaking over there. So Burke wants to say it was a subtle burn. Siri has to get help because it sucks. That's what Burke said.
Yeah.
I'm sure we'll hear from some of you who don't agree with Burke. Send your emails to Burke.
So he also talked about ambient computing, which I think that is really the most fascinating thing about these speakers. Not the hardware itself, but just the fact that we're getting used to just computers being everywhere.
Omnipresent.
Just you're shouting into the void and, someone's answering you, or everything's a screen and you're, tapping. And it sounds both enticing and also terrifying.
Yeah. It makes me wonder how much, because, I fully admit we live in a very tech-focused bubble here, not only at Twit, because we're surrounded by it all the time, but in, Silicon Valley and in California in general. How much is this particular technology breaking through to just the everyday person? Like, I was talking with my trainer earlier today, and we talked a little bit about Apple's announcement or whatever, and he expressed absolutely no interest. Like, I could just pull out my phone and do that. And I wonder how many people actually still really feel that way. It's easy to think that, like, this is the next big wave. But I don't know how much, everyday people really care about this sort of thing.
I don't know either. I mean, I think that the HomePod is really for the Sonos crowd.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of people, but not your average person. I mean, when I look at the price of Sonos, I think, wow, that's really expensive. I do not like music that much. And and so if you do and you have that money, great. But I think it's aimed at a smaller group of people.
Yeah. We're another step closer to Verizon being the proud owners of a slightly used Yahoo, as shareholders approved the sale for $4.48 billion. Next Tuesday, everything should be wrapped up with a nice little bow, as that's when the deal should close. Once that happens, the plan is to combine Yahoo and AOL into a single entity known as Oath, for some reason. And Marissa Mayer, CEO of Yahoo, who was handed what amounted to a turd sandwich when she took the reins in 2012, will step aside from that role officially when that happens. There was also a vote held to approve basically a golden parachute for Mayer, valued at around $30 million in a combination of cash, severance, benefits, and stock shares. And by the way, she also has around $186 million worth of stock right now that she's walking away from Yahoo with. So she's going to be all right.
I don't think we have to worry about Marissa at all. The transaction will close on June 13, 2017. We do have to worry. I mean, I don't know if we have to worry about it, but a lot of people got laid off too. Same thing. But we don't have to worry about as much because the stock went up today. Then anyone who got payouts in stock, they're going to be doing a little better than they were doing yesterday.
A little better, yeah. That's a really good point. Yeah, so the layoffs, are they like official announced? Or this is going to happen once the deal closes? 15% of AOL and Yahoo staffers are going to be, like you said, laid off. That's around 2,100 redundant jobs. They were really focusing in. They took a lot of time to kind of analyze the redundancies across, you know, as a result of the combined efforts of the companies. So, and then of course, just FYI, Tim Armstrong, who's the current AOL CEO, will then head Oath. I always look at Oath and I want to say OAuth. It's hard for me to switch that. But
what does it stand for? Something? Oath?
No. I don't believe
just
it does.
It's just a
statement.
Is it better or worse than the other half of the former Yahoo, which is Altbaba?
Altaba. It should be Altbaba because that's basically it's an alternative Alibaba. But definitely different.
Yeah, and they're going to become an investment company.
Yeah, they're going in a different direction.
Microsoft has acquired Hexadite, an Israeli security company based in Tel Aviv and Boston, to help beef up its enterprise security offerings. Executive VP Terry Meyerson says cyber attacks can cost between $12 and $17 million per incident. Microsoft did not say what it paid for the company, but sources are saying it's around $100 million. According to Mary Jo Foley, host of Windows Weekly, Hexadite was founded in 2014 by veterans of an intelligence unit of the Israeli Defense Forces. So this isn't for your average cybersecurity. This is for enterprise, which is where a lot of the bad stuff really happens. They use AI to detect and defend against cyber attacks, and it's going to work with Windows Defender and Advanced Threat Protection. And then following the deal, the Hexadite will be fully absorbed into the Windows and devices.
Like falling into a pile of Jell-O.
A lot like that, yeah.
Totally. Hexadite, apparently, like you said, AI uses AI to kind of take security from a human perspective, or more or less as much as you can get with AI and machine learning on the back end. And basically how it works, kind of its priority is to work to identify and actually automatically stop smaller issues so that it doesn't overwhelm the actual humans that are working to fight against the bigger things. It kind of zeroes in on those bigger problems that need attention from security teams, saves them from worrying about the little stuff so that they can focus on the big stuff. Mm-hmm. And I mean, security's obviously, it's a very, very big thing right now. Microsoft's had a bunch of security acquisitions that have happened over the past few months. What are those other companies? Aerado, Adalum, and Secure Islands. So they're kind of on a roll, a security roll.
Mm-hmm. And they say that, you know, they would rather use people than AI, but there is a dearth of good talent out there in that, you know, because it moves so fast. So I don't know. That's what they say. Mm-hmm. Whether or not that's true, I'm not.
Yeah. Amazon is switching things up and saying goodbye to unlimited cloud storage for Amazon Drive. Effective immediately, new users won't actually be given the unlimited option. Users with an existing unlimited storage plan for their data will not lose it until their renewal is up, at which time they'll be automatically downgraded down to the 1 terabyte plan and asked to pay an additional $59.99 per extra terabyte or $11.99 per 100 gigabytes. Without purchasing extra data, anything that's remaining there will stick around apparently for like 6 months or so, at which time you can say bye-bye to that data. Bye-bye.
This made me really mad. Not because I have a bunch of stuff stored at Amazon. I also have Amazon Prime, so yeah. You know, I still have the free storage.
Yeah, free photo storage sticks around for Prime users.
Right, but Microsoft did this too. They said unlimited storage, and then they said, we really aren't going to give you unlimited storage. And, you know, a terabyte is a lot. But at the same time, you know, I began to realize, and we were talking about this in the office earlier, and I said this to Padre, and he was like, yeah, of course they're doing this. Like, it feels like they're just trying to pull the wool over everyone's eyes. They're like, yes, unlimited storage. Come on, first one's free. And you put all your data there, and then, then it's already there, and you're like, okay, well, $12 a month, I guess that's not that much, and all my stuff is already there, so.
It's brilliant, isn't it? Conversion.
It makes me just want to put everything on iCloud and pay the $9.99 a month and just be done with it because they never told me it was going to be unlimited for free.
Yeah.
They never lied to me like Microsoft and Amazon did.
Fair enough.
And when Amazon announced this, they completely disrupted, I hate to use this word, but they really did disrupt the cloud pricing structure. This was at the point where Dropbox had cornered the market on this, and then they charged, and you know, everyone moved their stuff from Dropbox. They, you know, they took their stuff away and moved it to Amazon, and then now they're taking away the free storage. device.
Yeah. I mean, to say unlimited and to know, I mean, I guess I, as a user, anytime I've seen these, because like you said, they were all kind of doing this for a while, where it was like, we got to, you know, cloud's the big thing right now. We've got to get everyone on our cloud. So we'll offer you unlimited storage, and that'll entice you to put your files. Maybe you're using multiple services, or maybe you're just putting it, you're moving it all over to us, but that gets you through the door. And that's what these things are really all about. It's they can take the hit probably on a short-term basis. Like I assumed when I saw unlimited on these things that it probably wasn't going to last forever, because I mean, how does that scale infinitely? It doesn't. And then, yeah, when we were talking in the office about this a little bit earlier, like, you know, Google offers unlimited free photo storage. And so then there's the question, okay, well, it's unlimited now. Is that going to go away? And, you know, I think you have to also kind of look at the companies that are behind this. Google has a lot of stuff and a lot of benefit that it pulls from the data that is stored on its servers, you know, maybe even a little bit deeper than Amazon does. Amazon's keeping photos free, or not free, but unlimited for Prime users. And they could actually probably learn a lot from that data around, you know, the other services that they offer. So as long as they can leverage that data in other ways that still makes the company a lot of money, then they'll probably continue to offer it for free. And now I think they believe that they can do conversion because that's what everybody else is doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it was Drew in the chat room. It spun by me, so I'm sorry if it wasn't you, Drew. But someone was saying, you know, Microsoft didn't lie. They didn't think that that people were going to abuse the cloud storage, basically, like just using terabytes and terabytes of data for whatever. And I believe that. So now I was thinking, like, oh, was that just a story too? Like they knew that people would do that. So I don't know. I mean, and also it should be said that we store too much stuff. We, like, the cloud is...
We're digital hoarders at this point.
Right. And it might be free, but it costs resources. You know, it costs... Yeah. It has to, like... It's not actually a fluffy cloud up there, you know? Yeah. It is... it's not great for our environment. And I'm the worst. I'm not the worst, probably. But, like, I just shove everything up into Google Photos. And, yeah, they're using it for whatever, to, you know, take over the world, bring on the robot apocalypse. But yeah, maybe this weekend for the Earth, I will delete some photos. You too.
I'm conflicted on that too, because I agree with what you're saying. At the same time, cloud storage is really good for backup, because in the sense that if you're backing up to a drive that you have in your house and your house catches on fire, you don't actually have a backup. It all went up with the fire. And so one of the easier ways to do that is to back up to the cloud and have that go out there. So
But I'm backing up, like, when I accidentally took a photo of the ground, or when I accidentally took a screenshot of on my Apple Watch.
It's an amazing picture of the ground, by the way. That ground was awesome.
Or just, you know, when I accidentally took a half an hour video because my video was playing in my pocket. Like, those sorts of things. Like, I could tidy it up a bit.
Yeah, that's true. But, man, who wants to?
Not me. I want to do that just about as much as I want to clean up my LastPass and get all those passwords.
Someday.
Bloomberg reports that Andy Rubin's Essential startup that we told you about last week is now worth almost $1 billion, $993 million to be exact, so just short of unicorn status. The company recently raised $3 million in funding, and it could have been more. Rubin, the founder of Android, had tried to join the fund at SoftBank Group. That's the group that, but then they got kicked out after Apple joined the fund because SoftBank wanted to avoid the comparison of the two companies. That's according to sources at the Wall Street Journal. Rubin also spoke at Wired's conference this week, where he said that the duopoly of Apple and Samsung has created complacency in the smartphone business. And we should say that the funding numbers, that almost $1 million, were calculated before the products were announced and not based on the public's response to them. I wasn't there that day when you were talking about it, but you and Nate were kind of like, meh, about the Essential phone. And
I'm actually quite interested in the Essential phone. I think, yeah, I'm interested in the phone, and I'm very interested in anything that Andy Rubin does, because he created Android, and I have faith that he can do something very exciting. I have doubts on how successful it will be, at least in the short term. But they've even said, the COO of Essential told TechCrunch they have a 10-year plan, and the gist of the plan is that it puts off maximizing their profitability so that they have plenty of time to build that brand, slow sales growth. So they know it's going to take time. And, you know, this first phone only being available through their site, like, they've got an uphill battle if they're going to compete with the likes of Samsung and Apple in smartphones. And that's just smartphones. I think what they're doing that's smart is, it, from what it sounds like and more information that we're hearing about Essential, is that this isn't a smartphone company. They've got plans that extend beyond that. They've got patents filed for smart glasses. They've got their home product. I think Andy's really sees this as as a much broader effort than just smartphone, which they probably have to do to build that brand up. We'll see how successful they are.
But there were no features of the smartphone that were that exciting to you. But you're saying you want to be more forward thinking about the company.
No, I think the phone is actually it's a pretty premium, looking device. I think it'll be a great pick for people who want to buy something that's very eye catching, and it has some, unique characteristics about it. It's their first phone, and I guess I'm curious to see how their portfolio builds out over the next couple of years to see how they continue to differentiate. Just only being available through their site is really going to limit them. At least in the U.S., it's going to be very limiting.
Mm-hmm. So it's going to be $700, and then the speaker will come out later this year. Ruben at the Wire conference also said that he thought Apple's AR kit was not ready for prime time, so threw a little bit of shade at Apple.
Yeah. Meanwhile, I've seen a video I saw a video earlier today that was really, really impressive. That was showing off some of the AR kit technology of like walking in a room and having a kind of an avatar mounted to the ground. And I mean, it looked as Tango as Project Tango was to my eyes. I don't know how molded or crafted that video was, but I was actually really impressed. By the way, it's $300 million. Burke had a card up that said we may have said $3 million. It's $300 million in funding. But I mean, yeah, like you said, almost a unicorn. So that's pretty high up there. I think they've got big plans for Essential, and I'm curious to see where they take that.
Quick reminder, you can comment on anything that we discuss by emailing tnt@twit.tv. And of course, subscribe to Tech News Today at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. You can find all the ways at twit.tv/TNT. After the break, Kyle Weens from iFixit tells us what it looks like inside the belly of the new 4K iMac. But first, let's take a minute to thank Rocket Mortgage, the sponsor of this episode. The mortgage experience wasn't keeping up with the times. It was dated, and it needed a client-focused technological revolution. And they got one with Quicken Loans, Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing loan. It's simple. All you have to do is sign up, and then you can fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's super convenient. They have trusted partners that allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button, and it's powerful. So whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 21st home, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in just seconds. Based on your income, your assets, and credit, Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of the home loan options for which you qualify and find the one that is just right for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/TNT. That's rocketmortgage.com/TNT. Don't forget, if you go, which we hope you do, add the TNT at the end so that they know we sent you. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of Tech News Today. Apple just announced new iMacs on Monday, and already our friends at iFixit are tearing them apart to see what's inside. Joining us today to talk about what he discovered inside the brand new iMac Intel 21.5-inch Retina 4K display is Kyle Weens, founder of iFixit. Welcome back to the show, Kyle.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Megan.
So you found some pleasant surprises inside the iMac. Tell us about them.
I did, yeah. So we started taking it apart the normal way. You know, we have our iMac, and I have all the tools pulling it apart. And we got inside, and the main board was a little bit bigger than we were accustomed to. And so this is the board. And what's exciting is that right here, these are RAM upgrade slots. And so this is the RAM that is inside the iMac. And yeah, I took it out, so it wasn't soldered on the board, which is chaos.
Is this the first time with an iMac that you've popped open where you've found kind of these removable parts? I know historically it's been a very difficult computer to upgrade.
Yeah, well, a few years ago, I think the 21-inch was like this, where you had to pull it apart and then you could get inside. You know, the 27-inch still has the door on the back of it, but the 21-inch iMac, yeah, so this is in the category of things that Apple says are not user serviceable but actually are.
Okay.
So this is really interesting. And I mean, of course, their baseline, you know, the baseline 1099 model comes with 2 4-gig chips. So you've got 8 gigs of RAM, which is okay, but it's not great. But, you know, RAM from Apple on their, you know, upgrade path is always kind of expensive through the store. So the idea that you could do it yourself and save some money is pretty exciting.
How easy is it to do?
You know, so we rate it as a repairability score of 3, which sounds intimidating, but that's, you know, we want to let people know that, you know, there's a bit of a process. So we're putting together a kit so people can upgrade it themselves. And we have a repair guide. The previous repair guide for the 2015 4K model, it's basically the same process to get inside this. So in order to get inside, you need a few things. I have here, this is the first thing that you need to get inside is a pizza cutter. This is the special iFixit pizza cutter. It'll work on very, very thin crust pizza.
Okay, good to know. That was my next question.
Or very thin. I mean, it's actually a Delrin. It's kind of an incredibly precise thin piece of plastic. And you slide it in, and you're actually cutting adhesive around the edge of this. Apple used to use magnets, and so you could just take suction cups on the glass and pull it off. But when they wanted to make it a little bit thinner, they had to get rid of the magnets, and so they went with this foam. And it seems intimidating, but it's really not that bad. You just stick the pizza cutter, you go all the right way around, and you can lift the glass off.
Wow.
Can you use an actual pizza cutter? Would you recommend using an actual?
I don't think I would recommend that because you might break the glass. And with this, one of the reasons we give a low repairability score is from a repair perspective, if you break the glass, it's very expensive because the glass and the LCD are fused together. So breaking the glass would be the same as breaking the entire display. So don't do that. Don't use a real pizza cutter. You need our tool. We've spent a lot of time kind of tinkering, trying to find something else. I'm generally a fan of like kludgy DIY solutions. In this case, you really want this tool to get it open. They're not that expensive. And then you can get inside. And some of the other things in our kit, we've got so this is kind of like a credit card, just a plastic pry tool. And there's quite a few different screwdrivers that you need. So this little screwdriver kit comes with all the various screwdrivers that you need. And then it also comes with replacement adhesive. So this is kind of once you take it apart to put it back together, you have to replace the adhesive around where the display is.
Everything in the kit is under $10. The pizza cutter, which you call the iMac opening tool, is $7.95. So could you use that to open up an iMac too? Do they use the same? I mean, iPad or an iPhone? Do they use that same? No.
Yeah, nice thought. No, we recommend. I mean, a lot of the tools in this kit, so like the spudger, we use spudgers to take apart iPads and iPhones. But this particular tool is really designed for separating foam adhesive, the kind that currently Apple's only using on the iMacs. This will work on any of the new iMacs. So what we decided, what you really want is just to buy the RAM and have a kit. So we put together a 32-gig RAM kit that we haven't launched yet. You guys are the first people I'm telling about. So 32-gig RAM kit with all the tools. On Apple's site, if you want to upgrade your 8 gigs of RAM to 32 gigs of RAM, it's $600. We're going to launch our kit tomorrow for $300 for 32 gigs of RAM and all the tools you need to do it yourself.
Nice. Cool. Nice.
So if your time, if you can do it in an hour or two, save $300, that's pretty good.
Yeah, no kidding. Although it's going to feel a little weird pulling that display off for the first time. It's going to feel a little weird about it. I know that would scare me a little bit, but hey, that's why I don't pull iMacs apart, I guess, and you do it for us. What does it mean? You had in your teardown that the CPU is socketed in this iMac. What does that mean about repairability or replaceability, that sort of thing?
Yeah, so this is fantastic news. And so this is where the CPU socket, or this the CPU was, we removed it. The model that we have, this is the low-end model, so it had an i5 processor. So this is really cool. This is the Kaby Lake Intel architecture. That's the big reason for the upgrade. And it's a Kaby Lake socketed processor, which means that if you get the low-end iMac and you want to go on Newegg or from someone like us and get a higher end processor, you can just drop it in, and we're doing testing now, so we're 100% sure that it works, but we're like 98% sure that a faster processor will work just fine in it.
So this was obviously a conscious decision on Apple's part to allow people to swap out the CPU and the RAM. I mean, do you have any idea why they did this?
So we have, I mean, there's two possible theories. One is, out of the goodness of Apple's heart, they love us and they just wanted to do it because they love us, which is possible, although I think the last few years maybe have taught us to be a little skeptical of that. The other idea is that perhaps Apple's at the very bleeding edge of Kaby Lake and Intel didn't have non-socketed processors that they could use. And so Apple had to use the socketed version. That seems a little bit hard to believe considering how much clout that Apple has. So I tend to maybe they're just – I mean, they understand how much frustration the pros had. I mean, if you look at all the frustration that we have had with Apple the last 2 years, if you drive it down to its core, it's really been – these machines have not been upgradable. So there's been absolutely no choice. Normally, the pros, the folks that are in the top, you know, 1% that are blogging about how much we love Apple or hosting shows like this – we're really passionate and we're willing to do the upgrading. And so by Apple cutting off the upgrade path for the 1% of people that were the most interested, they created a lot of public frustration for themselves. So maybe they see something like this as a kind of release valve where 2-3 years from now, if they don't get around to upgrading the iMac, hey, that's okay because we'll get whatever the fastest Kaby Lake socketed processor Intel has and throw it in there.
Curious to ask you about this. It's related to what iFixit does, as a business, maybe less so about this particular teardown, but the Supreme Court, it was a couple of weeks ago, had a ruling around people's right to repair their own gadgets. That's kind of what you guys do for a living. I have to imagine you were following that closely. What did you think of the outcome? What was the potential impact for you guys?
Yeah, we were. I was actually involved in one of the amicus briefs to the Supreme Court. So we were very involved in that. The case, this was Lexmark v. Impression. So there was this little mom and pop company, Impression, it was buying old Lexmark cartridges, refilling them and reselling them. And Lexmark didn't want them to do this. And they sold them for patent infringement, saying, hey, this printer cartridge that you're selling infringes on our patent. And Impression was like, yeah, no, duh, you made it the first time. We shouldn't have to pay you a patent license every time we refurbish the cartridge. And so this had broad sweeping implications because if the Supreme Court had sided with Lexmark, it would have meant that like your used car salesman down the street might have had to pay Ford patent licensing fees for selling a used car. Like it was a broad sweeping potential ruling. And the Supreme Court fortunately ruled on the side of sanity and ruled in favor of Impression and against Lexmark and said, no, once you have sold the product the first time, your patent rights are exhausted. That's the legal term, exhaustion. Patent rights are exhausted, and so you can resell it as many times as you want. And so this is a very big deal. It means that folks like us who are like buying used products, taking them apart, selling used parts, that we're not infringing on the patents of the original manufacturer.
So is this the end? I mean, do you have to find another cause now?
Well, so, you know, right to repair is complicated. There's a lot of aspects to it. So this means that it's legal to sell used parts. That's great. But there's a lot of other problems that we have. For example, Apple has a magic tool that will calibrate the Touch ID sensor on the iPhone. So if you install a new Touch ID sensor, there's no way to make it work without having Apple's fancy machine. So there are right to repair laws being considered in 12 states now that would require companies like Apple sell diagnostic tools and make service manuals available. So now right to repair isn't one yet, but this is, you know, one step down a very promising road.
Well, Kyle, it is always a pleasure to talk to you. You also tore down the new PowerBooks and the new MacBooks. Nothing, you can see the teardowns there. But
I wish there was a new PowerBook. There's no new PowerBook.
Oh, the MacBook.
Yeah. So the new MacBooks and the MacBook Pros, and they are incrementally better, and it basically just swapped out processors inside, and they're good to go. So I'm curious. I want to know if you guys were going to buy a new iMac, like which one would you get, and like what upgrade path would you follow? Like all of a sudden we get to talk about this with a Mac product. It's kind of exciting.
That is exciting.
If you're going to buy an iMac and you've got, you know, $1,500, $2,000, what do you do?
Oh, I thought you were going to say, do we both have $2,000? Like if we both
we
have
$2,500. Pool our money together.
If we both had $2,500, we might get ourselves the new iMac Pro.
They're all looking pretty appealing. I mean, the iMac line is at a really great place right now. I remember when the iMac line was this like almost like a budget, like lazy, you know, lazy direction to go when you wanted to get a Mac and you didn't want to go total bottom, but you didn't want to pony up for like the Mac Pro or something like that. And now they've got it to a point to where it's really, I don't know, they're all very appealing. Obviously, you know, they scale differently for different capabilities. Personally, I would want as much power as possible, so I'd wait till the end of the year until the big one comes out. That'll be my choice.
But he didn't give us that much money, Kyle.
I know. I'd save my money.
So if you got the $1,100 one and then max out the RAM and put like a 2 terabyte SSD in it right now, that would be another maybe $500 on top. So now you're at like $1,600 and you've got the low end processor now, which doesn't give you the max power, but that's okay. Wait a year, buy a new KB Lake in a year and throw it in there. Which would be, I mean, you know, the iMac Pro isn't coming out until December anyway, probably January.
Yeah.
So I think you can get a lot of the power. I mean, I would think if it was me, the lowest end iMac is the most attractive one right now, which is crazy.
Yeah. Huh. Well, I mean, I don't really do, I mean, Jason's a musician. He does some of that stuff, but I don't really do anything. Like, I'm thinking I just need to get more used to using my iPad Pro as a laptop, because I really, I mean, all that power and everything would just be for show at this point for me. Because you don't need
you will rip my laptop out of my cold dead hands. I'm not switching to an iPad.
Yeah.
Tim Cook's life.
This one had a lot of life in it, and I'm ready. You know, I was almost tossed it aside for a Surface Book. So
yeah, that lasted a few days.
Yeah. Well, Kyle, it is such a pleasure. Before you go, I wanted to make sure I found this photo on the internet, and is that you?
Yes,
that's the most adorable thing in the world. Like, I bet a lot of people watching here took apart vacuum cleaners as a child or other. I know my children did. Burke did. How old do you think you were there?
I must have been like 4. And I remember trying to fix the vacuum and I never could. But that vacuum, it got so stuck in it would like smoke. I remember the rubber burning smell of vacuum.
I know that smell.
Well, Kyle, thank you so much. Kyle Weens is at kweens on Twitter, ifixit.com, and kyleweens.com. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Kyle.
Giving us your time.
We're rolling out this kit tomorrow, I think.
Awesome. Right on. Check that out.
Site.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thanks again, Kyle. We'll talk to you soon.
And we should mention that iFixit is a sponsor of the network, not the show, but the network, and has been for a while. And we love their products.
Yep, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Coming up, we take some time to read and answer a bunch of your feedback. We have so much, so we decided, hey, let's give you the spotlight for a little while. But first, let's take a minute to thank Oars and Alps. They're the sponsor of this episode. That's right. It's time to talk about your skin. I'm looking at you. We're going to talk about your skin. GQ calls Oars and Alps a new essential for your daily routine. And this is it right here, a box full of Oars and Alps. It's powerful skincare made for a guy's dehydrated skin and active lifestyle. Oars and Alps Face Cleansing Stick, for example, is the first men's solid face wash. It's spill-proof. You can see nothing spilling out of there. Oh, by the way, that's because it's solid. Like I said, activated charcoal. It gently exfoliates. It pulls impurities. You just put it on your face, splash a little water, and you're good to go. You've got the 2-in-1 hydrating and anti-aging face and eye cream, which is not greasy. I'm not a huge fan of like face cream because it makes my skin greasy. This doesn't do that. It's also fast absorbing. And then, of course, because you want to smell good, they're no nonsense. Natural deodorant. It's going to nourish your skin, absorb odor, which is the most important thing in my book. Everything's super portable. It's TSA approved, made with powerful and natural ingredients that offer intense hydration and smell really nice too. Products last up to 3 months. Oars and Alps products were developed by 2 women, Laura and Mia, for their husbands. They partnered with leading chemists and created Oars and Alps to protect their husband's skin from the extreme outdoor conditions that they were experiencing, often resulted in dry and cracked skin. Laura and Mia set out also to solve a common problem, which is spilled product in gym bags. How do you make this stuff portable? So they created the first solid face wash for men. And that makes it so that you can take this anywhere you go, gym, work, travel, on your next adventure, hiking, you know, hiking to the top of the Alps, or rowing, maybe with your, you know, Oars and Alps. It's right there in the name. Whatever, wherever your journeys take you, your skincare should keep up with your on the go lifestyle. And it's a great gift, very different gift that maybe the father in your life was not expecting. So there you go. It's a good gift idea. Oars and Alps is offering the TWIT audience a fresh start for your day. Join the thousands of guys using Oars and Alps. Visit oarsandalps.com/TWIT to receive 15% off your first order. That's Oars and Alps, OARSANDALPS.com/TWIT And we thank Oars and Alps for their support. All right. Feedback time. Let's check out a bunch of your feedback from the past week, because we got a ton. If we had a mailbag, it would be full. Mm-hmm. But we don't actually have one. We have an inbox. First, Dave from Tampa, Florida, wrote in about how Airbnb hosts are coming under fire for ADA violations. Dave wrote, I have a spinal cord injury and because of that must use a power wheelchair. I recently tried scheduling a vacation for my family using Airbnb. And while I didn't feel discriminated against, I can definitely say it was challenging finding a place that was accessible. I ended up just booking a hotel because I was confident that they would meet my accessibility needs. I'm a proponent of accessibility for people with disabilities. That said, one of the key aspects of the ADA is, will making something accessible impose an undue hardship on the owner? I don't think it's reasonable to expect private homeowners to make their facilities accessible to the letter of the law. Commercial properties are a different story. Accessibility for people with disabilities is a very complicated matter. I think it's important to educate Airbnb sellers on accessibility, what it means, but I also think it's important to educate the public that people with disabilities using Airbnb is a real market segment, and those able to accommodate customers with disabilities may be able to cash in on it. So it's an opportunity for some of the hosts essentially to kind of step up and realize that they can expand their market. You know, Airbnb hosts are always looking to maximize, you know, their filling up their schedule, and this is a great way to do it. Stand mm-hmm. out. Make some changes that are going to appeal to that market.
Yeah, when we reported this story, I saw some people in the chat room were saying that they were Airbnb hosts and, you know, their property was ADA compliant completely, and they got a lot more people there to stay for that reason. And so, yeah, I mean, I love hearing from people who, and specifically this story, I asked to get feedback from people who had experience for this, because often it's not as simple as it sounds. Like he said, you know, the idea is to make people aware of how they can make their places more compliant.
Right, right.
And Lee also wrote in about the Airbnb story. He said Airbnb has turned on the welcome light to lawsuits for their hosts. Airbnb has required some homeowners to sign away a protected positive right, which can't be done, that gives the appearance that participation by host agrees that their home is open to the general public business, which falls under a myriad of regulations and laws, including the American Disability Act. The 1964 Civil Rights Act specifically exempts under accommodation private primary residents that rent out to no more than 5 rooms to discriminate for no reason. The argument can be made that a 1964 newspaper ad to rent a room is what Airbnb is today.
I suppose so.
Yeah, the Airbnb policy is a win for the hotel motel industry. And once the lawsuits start on private residents, say goodbye to the host and cheap rentals in primary residence.
That one paints a much more dire picture.
It does. And so, you know that hotels, because their business is getting, you know, eaten alive by Airbnb. So they've been doing a lot of this kind of like, how can we get them, you know, because we have so much money and, you know, they can be easily make their places ADA compliant, then how, I'm not easily, but, you know, they have more money than your
They have
average.
To. It's an imperative for them.
Yeah. So it is really interesting. I mean, I hadn't thought much about hotels or rental places at all. I'm sure if you were just like a tiny little actual B&B, you know, that's been around for ages,
right,
this is probably not so easy for you either, because, you know, it's just you've been doing this sort of under the radar, and now there are more regulations. And I totally get what he's saying, like that doesn't seem right that they've put this on the hosts. Mm-hmm. When they're the company, they're the ones making a whole lot of money.
Right.
This. So we'll see. There was an interesting Airbnb story that we didn't cover today that I meant to put in the rundown. And it was another one of those announcements. It was that they are going to be opening thousands of places for refugees, Airbnb is. So I think, do you have the story there? It was, I think that they said that they were going to be doing this. And so they're not all bad. No one ever is.
And by the way, if you've ever stayed in an Airbnb, it's magical. It can be magical.
It can be magical, and it can be horrible.
Yeah, that's true. My only experiences have been magical. I haven't had the horrible experience yet, so I guess I'm crossing my fingers that doesn't happen.
Well, that's the thing. It's like you can have all kinds of experiences,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
it's
really
not like, oh, have you ever stayed in the Hilton? It's amazing. Like, it's...
Yeah.
And I'm not saying staying in a Hilton is amazing. I mean, it's not bad.
It's all right. It's all right. Ian from LA wrote in about a comment. Actually, I made this comment the other day about distracted driving. Ian writes, what app is Jason using to do his auto reply while driving? He says the Verizon branded Messenger app had a button you could press and it was awesome. I'm disappointed the standard Google messaging app as well as the Samsung app for my S8 do not have something similar. I don't understand it. I would love to have something to do that for me. And I think we mentioned on that day, I may have mentioned it quickly in passing, you had mentioned Android Auto, which is more like a driving platform. I mean, it's an app, but it's an app that gives you a window into all sorts of other things on your phone in a more in-dash friendly sort of way. And it does have the ability to intercept incoming SMS automatically, and then you have the ability to customize like a quick reply. So if you notice on your Android Auto timeline, you know, a big bubble that says, you know, so-and-so sent you a text message or whatever, you still, from what I understand, have to interact with it and tap to send that quick auto reply, and that happens. What I use is an app called Agent, and it has a number of features in it, but one of the features is specific to driving. It detects when your phone is in a motion that it is certain is driving, and it automatically mutes the phone so you don't hear, you don't see those notifications and calls. And if a message is sent to you, not only do you not see it, but automatically an SMS message or a messenger app, it works with a bunch of messaging apps, will send an auto reply that says, I'm driving right now, I'll get back to you when I get to my destination. And you can set that up so you can choose to have all of that working or choose to, you know, pair it back as far as how it works.
So it doesn't, your phone doesn't have to be paired Bluetooth to your car.
No.
It's just the motion. Yeah.
No, there's a chip inside Android devices, and it's built in. Can't remember if it started with Marshmallow or KitKat. But they basically started to be able to determine what activity you were doing based on kind of the gyroscope moving of the phone. And so they're pretty, it's almost 100% in my experience that it knows when you're driving. And if it detects that, then it can switch it over automatically. It has nothing to do with Bluetooth.
What if you're really fast at running?
And really steady?
Yeah.
Then you're Forrest Gump. I don't know.
Yeah, I think, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that Apple does not give access to third-party apps to that kind of location. I know with the new Maps app will tell you where you parked your car. Mm-hmm. So it knows that from only if you have connected your car to Bluetooth.
And
I mean, your phone to Bluetooth in your car. That's the only way. Like if you don't connect, then it won't know where you parked your car. So
right.
It doesn't know when you're driving and when you're stopping and when you're.
So it's all very reliant on kind of the Bluetooth connectivity,
right?
And knowing the last time I connected to Bluetooth, it was the car Bluetooth and you're not connected there anymore. So that's like a point on the map.
And I think that Apple would tell you that that's for privacy. They, you know, that people
right.
don't necessarily want to know, be, you know, sending up to the cloud, here's when you were in the car, here's when you got out of the car, here's when you, you know, started running really fast like a car.
Like Forrest Gump. Yeah, and then Google, basically what they do is they give you the ability to, well, and Apple does this too, but give you the ability to either sync your location or to deactivate that entirely. If you were to deactivate that, then much of this automatic functionality probably wouldn't work in the same way. You know, same as like find my, you know, where you parked your car. Mm-hmm. That's built into Google now, and that happens automatically behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. Every time I step out of my car, it logs it there. I never have to use it, but it's there, and because I keep my location shared.
Yes. So. Well, John writes about our discussion yesterday about Amazon providing discounts for people on assistance. And John sent me a very long, thoughtful email. I'll read this one first. It's just part of the second email he sent. John wrote, I know Amazon is a large corporation and they need to be dinged for a lot of things, but I think this particular program is helpful and responsible because it's not another freebie, but a discount that helps people be financially responsible. So we talked yesterday. We brought up this program that, in case you missed our episode yesterday, Amazon has offered discounts for Prime users who are on assistance. And you had to prove that you had this card in order to get the assistance. And I said that I had read that this might not make sense for some people on assistance because getting packages delivered might not work for them. And I guess I might have been, John said that he felt that I was a little callous. Mm-hmm. And it's true. I don't know what it's like to be on assistance. I've never been on assistance, so I apologize. I know usually for one email, one person who emails, like 10 people thought that. That's right. Sort of the rule. So
that's the math of it all. Yeah.
If I offended anyone by what I said yesterday, I totally apologize. It was not my intention. My intention was only to say that Amazon is this giant corporation. They are also doing this in their best interest. But the program is great if it works for one person, you know, who just needs temporary assistance. That's basically mm-hmm. what John was saying. Like, if you just need to, you know, to spend $5 a month instead of $10 a month to get cheaper stuff, that's great. I mean, and he said that he had the experience with getting groceries for cheap on Amazon, whereas sometimes when I look, it's like it's way more than just going to the grocery store. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we've talked about this before, it's really like Amazon sees people as people who have time and people who have time and no money. And money and no time. And mm-hmm. so they really want they want everyone. They would like to have everyone at their customer. But anyone who's willing to just ask their, you know, Amazon Echo to buy toilet paper and not care what the price is, they want those people badly too. You know, those people mm-hmm. are like, I can't bargain shop. So I just, so I apologize if I offended anyone. It was not my intention. And thank you, John, for writing in.
Yeah, thank you for that. And finally, Glenn has some information for those of us who would love to someday, like myself, see a Halo Warthog in person. This goes back to at least last Friday when Sam was on. Glenn writes, I was watching episode 1781 when you were talking about the Warthog that Weta built. This is the Warthog from Halo. Just to let you know that the Warthog is on display at Weta. If you do the Weta workshop tour, you can actually see it. It's pretty impressive. Weta Workshop is based in Wellington, New Zealand. It's that last part that makes it kind of difficult for me. But maybe someday I will make the pilgrimage out to New Zealand. Mm-hmm. I'm sure I will see that and a whole lot of other really cool things because mm-hmm. I've always wanted to go to New Zealand.
Mm-hmm. You could just relive the Lord of the Rings.
Yes. That's what I'd do. I'd relive it beginning to end. It would be a really, really long reliving. And the extended versions, of course, too. Up next, a plumber gets a theme park. But first, let's take a minute to thank Tracker. They're the sponsor of this episode. There's a ritual that we all know, looking for our keys. First, you check the obvious places, the places you expect it to be, couch, kitchen, pockets. You feel pretty stupid when it's in your pockets after all that other stuff. But if it's not, then you check the weird places, bathroom, fridge, hamper. Then you start getting creative. Looking at you, peanut butter jar. And then you get distracted and you get a spoon and you get some peanut butter. Snap back to it. 8 years ago, Tracker changed everything when they released their first tracking device. And now they've done it again with the all-new Tracker Pixel. With Tracker Pixel, you'll never worry about losing your things again. Tracker Pixel is the lightest Bluetooth tracking device on the market. You place Tracker Pixel on whatever you tend to lose, be it keys, wallets, even your cat. It's small enough to fit on your smallest items. When you misplace an item that has a Tracker Pixel attached, use your smartphone and a 90 decibel alert will help you find it in seconds. It'll sound, you'll hear it, you get it. It even has powerful LED lights so you can find your items in the dark. And if you lose your phone, you just press the button on the Tracker Pixel and your phone's going to ring even if you happen to leave it on silent. You can even locate your item if it's miles away because every Tracker user is actually part of the largest crowd locate network in the world. And Tracker's 30-day money-back guarantee means you truly have nothing to lose. So go to thetracker.com right now and enter promo code TNT. You're going to save 20% off any order. That's The Tracker, thetracker.com, promo code TNT for 20% off. And we thank Tracker for their support.
TNT's fan of the day is Gringo Loco on Twitter, who sent us this photo from his car outside the Twit studio saying he was catching up on TNT while watching the TNSS taping.
Waiting for it. Yeah, he was outside basically waiting to go in to be part of the new screensavers. taping anyways. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he was actually on the screensavers, but
did you guys not let him in? I don't understand. Why was he wait? Why'd you guys make him wait in the car?
The window going open, open.
Okay, Burke says
open.
He doesn't work.
Brian, we let him in. I don't know. I think I was there that Saturday. I can see my motorcycle in that photo.
Yeah, there it is. And your license plate.
Why didn't you let him in, Brian?
Pretty Jeez. Sure we let him in.
Maybe he got there early.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Thank you for watching us and the new screensavers. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. And if you come to visit, come on in. Come in early. We're always here. I mean, not us, especially if it's a Saturday because we're not here. If you want to come see us, tickets at twit.tv. And if you want to be the fan of the day, record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup, post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook. Use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT and we will find it.
I was just thinking, maybe someday in the future, he could come in with his phone, sit down and wait for the show. And while he's sitting there, augmented reality with his phone to watch us at the table. And we'll have to figure this out. We'll definitely have to figure this out, how we record this. Yes. But we can record ourselves so that when he's here, he can move around and his phone is like a window into a live taping. Mm-hmm. So it's like he didn't miss the live taping.
Yeah.
We can do that, right?
I do. I think we should start working on our augmented reality podcast.
We should do that. If we can solve this, we'll be millionaires. Totally.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of surprised. I never thought of this before. But now that I know that it exists or is about to exist, I realize how much we've all sacrificed by living without it for so long. Of course, I'm talking about a theme park built around Super Mario. It seems like it'll take a page directly, with at least according to this video, it looks like it takes a page out of the Super Mario 64 game, which is, by the way, the last major Super Mario game I ever played enough to beat. The theme park will be part of Universal Studios Japan, so it's a little bit of a trek for us here in the U.S., with a Mushroom Kingdom entrance. I think you'll pass through a pipe tunnel to get there. Grassy plantations, floating boxes. I don't know how they're going to pull that off. Mushroom pads, ice blocks, Bowser's Castle. Hopefully you can like jump up and hit bricks and it not hurt. And they give you coins that you can keep when you leave.
You can't fool me. I'm still mad about the Amazon Unlimited limited cloud storage. You're not fooling me. Do you remember the Pokemon Go preview? Like, before it came out, that video, the promotional video.
Oh, how awesome everything was.
Everyone was like crowded and like,
yeah.
Like, everyone did crowd in big spaces when it really came out, but they weren't like, yeah. They were just...
Yes, they were all hunched over.
I'll believe that when I see it.
Theme parks are always pretty big and they deliver.
But I mean, was that augmented reality Mario or was that?
Well, that was just like an announcement video. That wasn't the actual, obviously that wasn't the actual theme park. The very
obviously, last. We're just talking about augmented reality. It could be.
I guess so. Oh, see, that's the reality.
That's the real one. Yeah,
that's the real one. Okay, got it. Yeah.
You go there and everything goes to two dimensions.
Yeah.
And the I mean, the very last shot of that little promo kind of gives you an idea of the spread of the theme park. And I don't know, like, I think for a lot of kids, I think for a lot of kids of the Mario generation,
those are kids, they're not kids anymore.
The kids of the Mario generation are now much older, but I think that to a lot of them, like, Disney was passe. This was kind of their Disney. So it makes sense that there would be a theme park.
Makes sense.
I want to go. Let's all go.
We have a lot of places to go, too. We have to work on that augmented reality podcast app.
Yeah.
If we want to afford to. Plus, we got to make up that, you know, Kyle said he was going to give us each $2,000 for a computer, but we want a $5,000 computer. So we need to also.
Wow. We spent a lot of money on today's episode.
We really did. But I didn't buy Sonos. So there's
that. You saved a couple hundred dollars.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Dollar bills, y'all. TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 2300 UTC at twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show by emailing us, tnt@twit.tv. You can leave us a short voicemail, 260-TNT-SHOW, and you can find us on Twitter at TechNewsTodayTV.
And join us on our subreddit. That's technewstoday.reddit.com. I was there today. I was very pleased with all the stories that were there. I upvoted many of them. So thanks for posting them there. And you can find all the ways to subscribe to our show. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. Go to twit.tv/TNT and you can find all the ways you didn't even know about. And if you want to tweet at me, I'm at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell on Twitter. Thanks to our technical director, Brian Burnett, of course. Thanks to Burke for helping out in the studio. and his laptop. Thanks to Kevin for editing the show. And thanks to you for talking tech with us today. We'll see y'all tomorrow. Bye, everybody. Make it rain.